In the play Red, now on Broadway, Mark Rothko struggles to create a series of large works commissioned for the Four Seasons restaurant in the Seagram Building. The two-character play, which is as much about the relationship between Rothko and his assistant as it is about art, has been nominated for 7 Tony Awards this year, including Best Play, Best Director, Best Actor, for its 2 stars, Alfred Molina and Eddie Redmayne. And I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Redmayne to our show and Mr. Molina back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Alfred, are you making a specialty of appearing in movies and plays about art? You were in the play called Art. Then you played Diego Rivera in Frida. Now you're Mark Rothko. Interestingly, none of them with a British accent.
No, that's true. I think it's less of a sort of plan, more of a sort of coincidence, really. I think it has been odd, though. I also played a painter, a fictitious painter, in a film called The Trial, based on the Kafka novel, and it was that was interesting as well. And also with a not British accent. So I think I give good foreign. I think that's the secret.
And art. And Eddie, weren't you an art history major at Cambridge?
That's true. Yeah, there was a sort of when I left university, sort of about 5 or 6 years after leaving, you have this thing where you suddenly realize that you wish you'd taken your education more seriously and not got so drunk. And at that moment, when friends of mine were starting to go back to university and do postgrad things, fortunately this play arrived, and it's been a great excuse to go and reimmerse myself in that world, which was a world that I was always fascinated by.
Well, Rothko has always had a particular appeal to the British. The paintings that are the subject of this play wound up at the Tate, didn't they?
Some of them did, yes. The collection, there was reputed to be somewhere between 30 and 40 frames in various stages of completion when Rothko's was found, when Rothko's body was found. And seven or nine of them went to the Tate. Some are at the Washington National Gallery of Art, and a whole bunch of them went to a big collection in Japan.
Well, I suspect that the two of you went and looked at an awful lot of Rothko paintings. Had you thought much about them in Britain before you did the first production at the Dunmore Warehouse?
I'd seen a couple, but not with any. Not in the context of knowing that I was going to play Mark Rothko. As soon as that happened, both Eddie and I started some serious
immersion. I actually, in London, I live in Borough, which is just behind the Tate Modern, which is where the Seagram murals were kept until recently. Actually, when we were rehearsing the play, Fred and I and Michael Grandage, the director, and John Logan went up to Liverpool, where there's another Tate museum, and they're sort of doing a tour, I think, at the moment. But certainly, I mean, there was a 10-year negotiation between Sir Norman Reed, who was the curator at the Tate, with Rothko to try and persuade him to send some of those, to bequest some of those canvases. And part of that negotiation involved a room being designed specifically for him, the wall colour being he was completely a sort of dogmatic man, and the lighting. And certainly, when we've seen it, they've sort of reflected that now.
Yeah. In fact, there is the Rothko Chapel in Houston, which relies on natural sunlight, very dark paintings, and it's almost impossible to see those paintings 90% of the time. But Rothko was a rather demanding man, which is part of what this play is about.
Yes, it is, and it's interesting how when you play a character who had such an intellectual and moral rigor towards his work and towards how he wanted the work perceived and the demands he made on both himself and his audience, which is so completely in opposition to the way I feel about myself or anything I do. It's been a very interesting experience because we've also been very lucky, actually, in that since we've been doing the play in New York, some people who have been to see the play who own Rothko's have been very generous and allowed us to see their collections, and that's been wonderful.
But Fred, are you saying that artists are not all alike, that you as an actor are less concerned about the moral rigor that required?
No, what I'm saying is that I think there are, as the play points out, there's a whole spectrum of artists and temperaments and artistic temperaments and approaches to work, as there are human beings, really. I mean, in the play, we talk about the difference between Rothko's sensibility and Pollock's, and how their work was very much reflected through their own personalities. Their own personalities had a huge effect and resonance in the work itself.
You could have also talked about the difference between Diego Rivera's personality and Rothko's.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and what I find interesting about Rothko is that although there is that intellectual rigor, there is at the same time the most extraordinary exuberance in a lot of that work.
Well, they're mystical and beautiful. If anybody's been to the Phillips and been in that Rothko room and has not been transported by the art. Do you think that you learn something by looking at the art? Can you gain insights into a character that you're going to play by looking at the art?
Absolutely. I think what's been most fascinating for Fred and I is doing a lot of the research and going and seeing these canvases, but particularly, remember, we did some press for the play when it was opening. We went up to Washington. We went to the Phillips Collection and the National Museum. And there were some hilarious photos taken of Fred sort of confronting the canvas and my character looking at the side to see the staples and to see it. Because one of the great qualities for me in this play is, as the assistant, is the practical element of art. So the idea of building these canvases, of priming them, of sort of creating, boiling the paint and stapling canvas. And so it was interesting to see two different ways of approaching the research.
I'm assuming that Ken, the character you play, is an invention of the playwright.
He is indeed. He's an invention of the playwright, although another of these extraordinary circumstances that have happened since bringing the play to New York is that I got an amazing letter from a woman called Virginia, who was Dan Rice's widow. And Dan Rice was Rothko's assistant during the Seagram murals. And he became a wonderful artist and I don't think he used the term, an abstract impressionist. And it's been really useful finding transcripts of his and seeing, although the character's backstory is fictitious, you know, getting an insight into what it was like working for this man beyond the context of the play has been kind of fascinating.
Rothko says that Ken is just an assistant, but isn't their relationship really something quite different? It's a mentorship, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. I think it's, at the risk of sounding rather grand. I mean, I think there are themes in the play which are positively epic. I mean, it's about the father, son, mentor, student. The play is essentially about the moment when the prince usurps the king, or as we say in the play rather graphically, when the son kills the father, and that's really the heart of the play, because a lot of people, I think, were concerned that the play was going to be simply some sort of rather witty exchange between two interested persons on the nature of art itself. But in fact, that isn't at all. Really.
Which you did in art.
Yeah, which we did in art. But again, in the same way that the discussion of art is always always secondary to what's going on between these characters on stage.
There's a father-son relationship, a mentorship relationship, and there's also just a power relationship, and the power shifts back and forth. And that's what the play's really all about, isn't it? It could just as easily have been about a fictitious artist and his assistant.
Yeah, it could have been. But I think
a musician
absolutely.
Assistant.
But I think what makes it such an interesting play is that it's quintessentially a New York story. And the one thing we've discovered in the difference between the British audience and the New York audience, of course, is that in England there was a sort of a slight distance between the events of the play and the audience. So people had London audiences had a slightly more sardonic reaction to it, whereas here the audience is absolutely on top of every topical reference, every historical reference, every geographical reference. It's a very exciting play to do here.
And wonderful, even when the sort of influx of the New York sounds outside of the theatre. I remember when we moved it here and you hear the sirens going past that kind of infiltrates the walls of the theatre. It does feel special to be doing it in the fabric of the city.
My guests are Eddie Redmayne and Alfred Molina, the stars, the only actors in Red now on Broadway. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We also performed it at the Dunmore Warehouse, which is a teeny theater in comparison to any typical Broadway house. So it must have been much more intimate in the original production.
Yes, it was. But and Eddie's going to tell you why.
No, but the Don Moir has the stage has audience on three sides. So here, a part of the design of the piece is that the front, the fourth wall, as it were, the artist Rothko and Ken imagine this canvas on the front. So in London, we were imagining canvases on three sides, and it's been extraordinary and challenging and wonderful finding it in a new space. And Fred was saying, you know, the audiences here have been quicker and more, I think, more sort of on the ball than the British audiences were. But certainly that change of intimate. I mean, the house we're in is one of the most intimate Broadway houses, but even so, it's the difference between 250 people and
this is
800. Yeah.
Well, I'd imagine also you are a lot more careful about your American accents here than you were when you were in England.
Fred doesn't need any help. I need all the help I can get. Yeah, no.
No, it's a real feeling of immersion here, and I've always noticed it whenever I've played when I've ever acted in the theatre in New York, that there is a difference, and I can't quite pinpoint it. I used to think maybe it was to do with the size of Manhattan, or perhaps the way that the theatres are laid out, that they all seem to be much, much closer together. I wondered, is it something to do with the sensibility of a New York audience and why they go to the theatre? Is it because they're spending so much more money that, you know, there's a difference between a difference in the relationship between them and the product? I don't know what it is, but it's a very, very different experience here. And for this play, it's worked absolutely in its favour.
Well, it's interesting when you walk down 45th Street and there's such a wider range of plays, array of plays, and the people who are waiting for one play look totally different than the ones who are waiting for the next one. You really do get a sense of the full strata of America.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you do have to worry about that accent. Fred has been a master of the American accent for a long time.
Mm.
What about you? How hard was it?
Well, I've done a few films and plays actually in London. I did an Albie play called The Goat, and so played American quite a few times. But certainly on film, you have someone with you day to day. You have someone listening into everything you're saying and coming correcting you between takes. I have a sort of an accent which I feel like I can pull off, but I did it in London and thought it was going fine, and then came here and was promptly told that it wasn't so fine. So we had a wonderful woman called Kate who is in charge of voice at Juilliard, and she came and helped me with it. And all those things are, I mean, they're all part of the fun of the toolbox that you have as an actor.
Mm. Well, of course, in Britain, actors all have a wide range of British accents. I remember when I lived in England, and there were people who told me I could tell whether a person was from this town or that town 12 miles away because the accents were so different.
Yes, and also because in England there's a whole class element to accents. There's one's accent carries all kinds of information about your education, your upbringing, and so on, that the listener will make some kind of assumption about. Whereas what's so wonderfully egalitarian about most American accents is that all they'll give you is a sense of the geographical location. They don't, you know, American accents don't quite have the same sort of social and cultural information. You're being very complimentary about my American accent. But there's been a few times when we discovered wonderful little mistakes, like the word television. In English, it's television, and here it's television. And with my American, I had a line where I say, "Everyone likes the television and the phonograph." And this lady came up to me and said, "It's actually television." Mm-hmm. It's a real giveaway.
Did she write you a letter?
She did. She wrote me a letter. Explain. And, you know, underlining all the stresses where I was getting it wrong, which I was very grateful for. Dear Mr. Molina, why was a perfectly good performance ruined by your pronunciation of the word television?
New kinds of notes for an actor. The two of you are pretty much on the stage the full time, and it gets pretty intense. Does it feel like a workout?
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, we are. Yes, it does.
Hell yes is my response.
But I think it's, you know, I would be loath to give anyone the impression that it's sort of, you know, really exhausting hard work in a way that is unpleasant. I mean, it's terribly exciting and invigorating.
And physical. There's that scene that everybody has remarked about where you prime a canvas together. Mm. You do this very quickly, and I suspect it demands a certain amount of energy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think something what I love about the play is I'm not sort of having to go to the gym much. It's because it's a full-on physical. It is a physical workout, and as we've said, the sort of practical sides of hauling these canvases around and priming, and that is an amazing moment for Fred and I. We've done a lot of talking up to that moment, and then to have a completely visceral physical release halfway through the play is always a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's great fun.
There's a key point in the play is that Rothko is going to be painting these paintings for a very fancy restaurant, although there was something that I objected to. He says at some point that the people at the restaurant would have no understanding of the play, the paintings. The people at that restaurant were the people who bought Rothko's paintings from the galleries, actually. But he has this crisis, and it's the crisis of somebody who wants to remain true to himself and true to his art. And this is something that a lot of artists were going through at that time.
Yes, and it's something that now, of course, seems to have been completely is not the case. I mean, now a young successful artist, now the idea of this kind of commission, I think, would be acceptable and regarded as a terribly wonderful, exciting thing to get a chance to do.
Well, of course, everybody thinks about that in relation to some of the films that you've been in recently, like The Prince of Persia. Does one pay, kind of subsidize the other?
A little bit. I mean, I think the truth is that I make my living in films. That's where most of my work is. But and it does, yes, it does subsidize a theatre habit. You know, it's like films. I'm married to films, but I have this girlfriend on the side called theatre, and she's very demanding and very capricious, but I can't quite give her up.
But you do wind up, you know, there must be a certain amount of victory when the critics say whatever they say about Prince of Persia or Sands of Time, and they always say, but Alfred Molina gave an incredibly wonderful performance.
Well, I remember Bob Hoskins, a wonderful, wonderful British character actor, who once said to me, he said, because we were talking about this, and he said, I love doing these character parts. They treat you like the crown jewels. You get paid loads of money, and if the movie stinks, nobody blames you. Which is kind of sounds like the perfect gig, you know.
There's a limited run?
Yes.
Only through June 27th. Does that feel bad? I mean, you have this hit play, people want to see it. You probably could extend it all the way through for another few months. Is it because you have other commitments?
So I think it's a mixture of that, other commitments ahead, and also we did it in London for a long period, and I feel like it's a play that is quite physically. I mean, you've slightly played it down, but maybe is quite physically exhausting, and doing it every night. There are only two of us on stage, that maybe it will lose some of its life if we sort of pummeled it on too long.
Yeah,
is there a point of a tipping point, as Malcolm Gladwell would have it, where something that you're really enjoying doing every night suddenly becomes a chore?
Well, I think there is a tipping point, but I'm not sure that it becomes so much a chore as somehow you reach a point where you know that you can't quite give it as much as you did. That it becomes slightly, the experience becomes slightly lessened by it.
Although other actors have told me that they're constantly learning things about their characters, and usually it's the last performance they do that's the best, the most complete, because now they finally understand that person.
Well, there's the horrible truth, which I've spoken, a lot of my friends have testified to this, that the morning after the last performance, you wake up and you suddenly, yes, exactly, slap your forehead thinking, oh, that's what that line meant.
And it's interesting. I was sent this transcript by this guy, Dan Rice, who was Rothko's assistant, and he talks about art being the idea of striving for perfection in the knowledge that you're never going to achieve it. And when I read that in relation to the, you know, fine arts, kind of blew my mind, because it's kind of what I feel like we do in theatre every night. Is you people go, how can you do a run for that long? And the answer is because you never get it right. You never get it close to right, but you keep aspiring.
I always tell my students, never trust the actor that comes off stage saying, I've just nailed it. Because you never do.
Well, that's why people write books, more and more books, paint more paintings, write music, play every night. Well, But it's a pleasure watching the whole process, and I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us, Eddie Redmayne and Alfred Molina. Red, which has been nominated for 7 Tony Awards this year, Best Play, Best Director, Best Actor for both of them. It runs through June 27th at the Golden Theater on 45th Street. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.